Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions, a local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire's 1st congressional district is one of the most high-profile and competitive swing seats in the country. Voters there have gone back and forth between Republicans and Democrats for more than a decade. Also, last year, it was one of a few that favored both President Trump and a Democrat for Congress. Now all eyes are on it again after incumbent Democrat Carol Shea Porter announced she won't seek re-election. And today in The Exchange, we'll look at all the political activity that's erupted since. Later on, we'll look at the 2nd district as well. But first, health care. President Trump, late last week, released what he called an executive order promoting health care choice and competition across the United States. The order makes several changes to the Affordable Care Act, including an end to subsidies for those Americans who purchase insurance on the health care exchanges. To gauge the impact on our state, we'll talk to a top official in the insurance department, but we're going to begin the hour with Governor Chris Sununu. And Governor, thank you very much for taking time out. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Laura. Anytime. How's everything going over there?
Well, good. And just great. Kicking off on a Monday morning with some technical language, CSRs, cost-sharing reductions, these are the subsidies that help middle-income and lower-income Granite Staters afford coverage on the Affordable Care Act's healthcare exchanges. We've talked a lot about this before, Governor Sununu. What's the immediate impact of the CSRs possibly going away?
Well, there's a couple things. So, when we, you know, I've been a supporter of CSRs and to keep them for quite a while. I've written many letters to the president, to Congress, encouraging them to keep them. And I really hope Congress takes up the call of the president and structures legislation that gets them back where they need to be, because it does affect the premium rate on a lot of folks. You know, when we saw the premium rate spike up about 45% about a couple months ago, we worked hard with Harvard and Anthem and some of the major carriers to make sure that they could stay in the exchanges and not go the way that other states had gone, where their healthcare exchanges had completely fallen apart. And part of that negotiation and part of that discussion was making sure that they knew that CSRs may or may not stay, even though we wanted them to stay. We weren't sure what was going to happen. So they kind of built that in to their thought process. So while other states have received this news and their healthcare exchanges are once again on the brink of falling apart, ours is not. I think we did a great job working with our providers to make sure that we have stability. Now, will premiums go up? There's no doubt. Premiums are going to go up probably another 10 points or so on top of the 45% increases we've already seen. Look, 45% was untenable. 45% increases were the clear sign that Obamacare is not working as a whole. But these CSRs just kind of add right on top of that. So premiums will go up again, but our health care exchange is stable. And again, we're calling on Congress. Hopefully Congress will start doing their job, start doing something to get some stability in our healthcare marketplace.
So 45% premiums are slated to go up. The uncertainty, as you said, Governor Sununu, was sort of baked into the cake. You guys didn't count on this happening. But 45%, does that mean people who used to get a subsidy to help with that huge increase will no longer get that subsidy?
As of right now, this subsidy that they're talking about, the CSRs, and it's such technical stuff, but
right.
It is critical for a lot of folks. Right now this subsidy isn't there. And what the president has said is, I'm not going to support this. It's a lot of money. If Congress wants to do it, that's the right way to do it. And so he's putting it on to Congress to find the solution, which, you know, putting it on Congress is actually the right thing to do. I mean, Republicans and Democrats agree with that. The laws come out of Congress. The laws come out of the House and the Senate, and that's their responsibility. This idea that, you know, everything is done by executive order, a lot of those were done by the previous administration. You can't do that. So whether you look at DACA, right, with our immigration laws or what he's doing with the CSRs, he's saying, look, Congress has to come together, find a solution, and put some bills forward, which they just haven't done yet on any of these major issues, which I think is everybody's frustration, frankly. So, you know, we'd love to see the CSRs in there. We've been promoting for them to stay in there. I was a little bit fearful that this would happen, but there is still a possibility that we can get some relief here. Now, there's some other bills that have been taken up that I'm very encouraged by. There's a bill out there by, I believe, Senator Nelson, who was looking at what they call these invisible high-risk pools, which really it doesn't directly have anything to do with the CSRs, but it's a way to lower premiums. It's a way to take some of these high-risk profile people, still provide them services, but it's really regulating and managing that risk on the back end, and it helps draw down premiums for everybody else. So my point there is there's a lot of solutions out there, and Congress has to simply get to work. There's a lot of good ideas. Start putting things forward and get something passed, because it's really up to them to lay the platform and foundation so the states can then implement these programs at a local level.
So at this point, Governor Sununu, and there's been so many changes and uncertainty and so forth, could you just clarify at this point how you feel about the Affordable Care Act? You've been critical of it, and yet you've also spoken in favor of expanded Medicaid and the CSR. So go ahead, just tell us how you feel about this law right now.
In terms of Obamacare? It's a disaster. Oh, no, I think I've been pretty clear. Obamacare is broken. It is broken. When you have 45% increases on the folks within the healthcare exchange, when you have to negotiate just to keep our healthcare exchange soluble, and it's been falling apart in other states across the country. I think we've just been really good about being proactive, working with both the insurance department, the providers, the Health and Human Services. We've frankly been very, very good about negotiating and working in a kind of a checks and balances, if you will, to make sure that we're viable. But these are just Band-Aids. Let's face it, these are Band-Aids to get us through a couple years, because Congress is not laying the foundation that was promised to the American people. Right. Everybody's costs are up. Right. The promise of Obamacare. Let's go back and understand what it was. The promise was prices would go down. That has been so wrong. It's gotten to the point. I mean, think for a second where we were back in 06 and 07. Right. We didn't have these types of crises. Obamacare has exacerbated our problems tenfold. So, look, it has failed. Now, what we have, you don't just throw it out. I'm not a fan of just, you know, repealing Obamacare and doing nothing. You have to have some long-term solution in place, and that's where Congress needs to actually pass something. So what they should pass should have flexibility. It should have the appropriate funding for the constituencies that we're talking about, and it should allow states to design the system the way they want to design it, whether it's with high-risk pools, whether it's making sure you deal with the elderly population, whether it's states like us who have to deal with the opioid crisis. That type of flexibility, which right now Washington is not providing, really limits and frankly wastes a ton of taxpayer dollars in the system. It's simply about letting the states do what they do best, which is manage, and so, which frankly Congress in Washington does really, really badly.
So you said Obamacare has exacerbated problems. You'd like to see something more flexible state by state, but that the federal government seems to still play a role in Governor Sununu, right? Am I hearing you right? That provides funding for like expanded Medicaid.
Yeah, it's our taxpayer dollars that are going down there. We get a fraction. People have to remember, in New Hampshire, we get a fraction of our federal taxes back to us, whether you're talking about infrastructure or healthcare or whatever it is.
That's because we're a relatively wealthy state, so we're not getting, you know, a lot of those social welfare payments that poorer states get.
Well, that's true. But one of the reasons is because Washington takes a one-size-fits-all approach to the whole country. They think that what happens in Arizona is what should happen in New Hampshire. We're not the same. Right. And no matter what you're talking about, whether you're talking about green energy programs or infrastructure or healthcare, we are not the same. And states and regions have to be treated differently because costs are simply higher. You're right. We have the highest per capita income. That's wonderful. We have a very low poverty rate, but it is rising, something we have to deal with. We have an opioid crisis. You can't treat every state the same. And that's where Washington does. They tried to get involved in the healthcare business, and it just got worse.
So some of the
is put the
Yeah, some of the issues, and I know you got limited time, Governor, so I apologize for jumping in there on you.
I'll stay on all morning. with you, Laura, anything. I'm sitting in a downtown coffee shop on Elm Street in Manchester, and I get to talk to Laura. This is great.
All right. Well, then I will throw a couple more at you and maybe even take a question from one of our listeners.
Sure.
You know, some of these repeal and replace bills, and you've been following this, Governor, closely, the debate, some of them strip away regulations, in the word of supporters, to help lower costs, supporters say. Some people say that's great. Other people hear that as code word for skimpy coverage that isn't there when you need it, coverage that may lower costs for younger Americans but raise it for older Americans. And as you know, Governor Sununu, New Hampshire is an older state. So I just love your thought there about, you know, how much of these mandates and regulations that are often criticized by Republicans should be stripped away, and some of the dangers there that costs may go up for older folks.
Yeah.
That's been part of the problem with some of these bills.
Sure. Look, I'm not trying to sound like a broken record, but the answer is the rules and regulations and mandates at the federal level absolutely should be stripped away. So states at the local level can design rules and regulations and structure that fits their needs. You know, it's very similar to what I was saying before. You got to get the federal government out of the game. They need to put up money, as they should, because frankly, it's our money, it's taxpayer money. They need to return those dollars back to the states with the flexibility for states to design their own rules. And I don't mean to make it just that simple, but it's just that simple. That alone would be a game changer. You know what we don't have in healthcare, if I may? We don't have a free market, right? You have a free market when you go buy a car or go buy a TV. You can choose, you know, businesses are competing, they're lowering prices. That doesn't even exist in healthcare. So the pricing for whether you're talking about the price of a liver transplant or a Tylenol in the emergency room is in the pricing into the insurance policy. And that's all we're really talking about so far is the insurance policy, which is a bit frustrating in itself. It's all dictated more by politics than anything, not by true free market dynamics, which in theory should lower everybody's price.
So let me ask you about that then. Since one of the pieces of what President Trump put out there, the CSRs has gotten most of the attention, but one of the other pieces of his executive order did open the door to wider acceptance and use of what are called association health plans, where you could buy insurance across state lines, you know, small businesses could pool together and so forth. So that's an idea that's out there that this presents and tries to build upon.
I
wonder
it.
How you feel about that, Governor Sununu.
Yeah, I'm. You know, we've been supportive of association health plans. You know, one good example. There's a couple examples in the state. I think one would be like the Auto Dealers Association that comes up from time to time. You know, we created a structure that allowed them to really pool everything together to get again. When you allow a lot of people to pool together, it gives you pricing powers. It helps instill a little more of a real market dynamic into that pricing power and therefore lower prices for your insurance policy. So allowing, whether it's across state lines or associations, people to pool together so individuals aren't stuck on their own against this massive system, right? You want to make it more of a fair playing field, and to do that by allowing people to join together, increase their pricing power and lower prices. So fundamentally, I love it. I still think that, again, the states should have the ultimate say in terms of figuring out their rules. And even regionally, right? If we're going to allow people to buy insurance across state lines, again, I love the concept, but that should open the doors to Vermont and Massachusetts and Maine and maybe pooling even across those state lines together, not just buying across state lines, but pooling larger associations across state lines to give, again, the individual buying power that right now they just don't have.
Yeah, the fear has been if you cross state lines, then state regulators can't check out these plans, make sure they're not so bare bones that they're, you know, almost not worth the paper they're printed on. So there's been a fear of this sort of race to the bottom if you open up that across state
lines.
Well,
I understand that concern, but I don't think it's fair because if you did nothing, then yes, that would happen. But what you do is you tell the states, we're going to have a certain amount of plans that are basically the same across state lines. Not every plan necessarily has to be available across state lines, but you provide four or five to a larger pool of people across the lines. You get the folks in Vermont, Maine, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, you know, throw all of New England there if you want. You get all those regulators into the room together and say, okay, we agree that these plans that we're going to offer across lines all look like this. So you just do the extra work to create the synergies needed to allow the individuals to have that type of option.
Governor Sununu, last question for you, please. What do you want to see happen next on this whole, you know, sort of uproar over the possible loss of CSRs?
Congress. It really comes down to whether it's our delegation or the federal delegation as a whole in the House and Senate, they have to do their job. I mean, can anyone point to anything Congress has done substantially, right, in the past 9 months? No, really not at all. Now, again, I'm not here just to ring my own bell, but whether Republican, Democrat, or Independent, you cannot deny we've gotten a lot of stuff done in this state. And we do it because, for the most part, we throw the politics aside, right? We're just looking at getting outcomes, long-term planning, not these short-term band-aids to problems that I think traditionally we've had. And that's the only way Washington seems to do anything, with short-term band-aids. They really need to get in a room together, Republicans, Democrats alike, and figure it out. That's their job. That's what we pay them so much money for. They have not done it to date, whether you talk about any of these major issues. And so whether it's CSRs or Obamacare as a whole, or these associated plans, whatever it might be, they've got to figure it out, and they've got to put something on the president's desk to sign.
Well, and here's an email from Matt in Vermont, who agrees with you, Governor Sununu. He says, I may pay more without the CSRs, but these subsidies are not legal. Matt says, why didn't the Democrats bake the CSRs into the law? He says, because it would have been an acknowledgement of the basic unworkability of the ACA, Matt says. Most of the ACA's failures were predicted by people without political agendas. But workability, Matt says, was not a concern of Democrats. Buying votes with free services and subsidies was the purpose. So Matt's kind of agreeing with you there, Governor Sununu. But I wonder what you think. You know, Democrats and Republicans didn't choose to fund these things. They counted on the administration to do it. So they're both kind of at fault there.
Oh, absolutely. Both sides are at fault. I think the Republicans are just as at fault as the Democrats. Of course they are. They didn't get it done. You need leadership in the Senate. And I've been a little disappointed with that, frankly. I think there's just more that can be done in terms of working across the lines, working across the aisles, putting an open handout, trying to find a solution. And look, you know, they give themselves all these deadlines in Congress, right? You got to either meet the deadline or move the deadline or do something. But you can't just say, we didn't get it done. We're going home on vacation. And sorry, we'll get to it next year. That seems to be the mentality in Washington. I don't get that mentality. You know, you got to manage. You got to do something. And whether it's putting politics aside or just being extremely bipartisan about it. And I think being extremely bipartisan is the right solution, frankly.
Well,
and you got to give something up, right? You cannot get the ideal solution. You can't. And you can't go buy off votes either. I mean, I love the flexibility that the last bill provided, the Graham-Cassidy bill, lots of flexibility. I did not like what it did to this state in terms of cutting $800 million of funding over the next 10 years. We got abnormally abused financially compared to other states. And you had states like Alaska that were getting abnormally too much money, right, to kind of buy off Murkowski and others, right? That is not management. Right. You got to get the people in the room and really make them think about the long term vision of what they're trying to achieve. Focus on the outcomes you want, not just try to buy the constituencies you need.
Well, Governor Sununu,
it's a different philosophy. You know,
I will let you go and we'll talk again. I really appreciate you taking time out for us this morning.
You bet, Laura. Anytime. Have
All
a
right.
good week.
Take care. That's Governor Chris Sununu. Joining us now on the phone is someone who has been watching this development very closely, Alex Feldwebel. He's Deputy Commissioner for the State Department of Insurance. And Alex, you heard the governor talking there, but I'd love to get your thoughts, too. What are the possible effects of these CSRs going away?
Well, it is pretty much as the governor described. In early August, the insurance department was looking at the growing prospect that the CSRs would not be funded. And so we put out guidance to the health carriers, allowing them to adjust the rates they were going to charge for the 2018 coverage to take that into account. And all of the three carriers that are in the market, Anthem, Harvard Pilgrim, and Ambetter, did that. So the sort of disruptive effect on New Hampshire is very much muted because of what has already taken place.
As Governor Sununu said, it was already, that uncertainty was already sort of baked into the cake. Alex, I'm going to hold you over a short break, okay? And when we come back, we will talk about just how many people may be affected by this, other possible ripple effects on the market beyond people who are purchasing healthcare on the exchanges. And then this idea that Governor Sununu said he likes purchasing insurance across state lines. So we will follow up with that after a short break. And then we will turn to the first congressional district where there has been a ton of political activity. We have some great guests who will help us unravel that. So all that's coming up. Plus, we'll take your questions and comments. Of course, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Alex, hold on. We'll be back in a moment.
Hi, my name is Arielle. I'm calling from Derry.
My name is Elise. I'm from Alaska.
My name is Ina, and I'm calling from Brooklyn, New York.
From the Alaskan wilderness to the streets of New York City, NHPR's Civics 101 is your guide to how American democracy works.
I had a question about term limits.
How does the Electoral College work?
Can you help me explain the National Security Council to my students?
Subscribe to the podcast and submit your questions at civics101podcast.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we are going to take a look at the 2018 midterm elections, especially that first district seat, which just opened up recently. There's been lots of political activity around that. So we'll take a look at it. But first, we have been taking a very quick glance at healthcare. There was a lot of uproar at the end of the week last week with President Trump's decision to withhold funding for the CSRs. These are the subsidies for some people who buy health insurance on the Affordable Care Act's exchanges. We talked earlier to Governor Chris Sununu. Alex Feldwebel is with us now on the line, Deputy Commissioner for the State Department of Insurance. And Alex, you were talking about the impact of the loss of these CSRs, these subsidies. Yeah. How many people are we talking about? Do you know?
Well, let me take a step back to really accurately talk about the impact. There are about 100,000 people who get their coverage in the individual health insurance market in New Hampshire. And there are about 25,000 who get the benefit of premium tax credits and cost-sharing reductions based on their income. Now, those people will not be directly affected by the elimination of funding for the CSRs because they still get those subsidies. So that's an important point. But what does happen is that the carriers, knowing that the CSRs were possibly not going to be funded, increase their rates for the whole market. So that's where we get these premium increases that our latest estimate will be an average 52% increase for the individual market.
And it's very confusing, Alex, and I appreciate you explaining it to us. So, but those increases, are those going to affect most Granite Staters who get their insurance, you know, through their employer? I mean, that's how most people get it.
No,
it's just for this select unlucky group of folks.
Right, yes. It's for part of the people who buy their coverage to the individual market. So it doesn't affect anyone who gets their coverage through their employer. And it won't directly affect those who get their coverage through the individual market if they are getting a subsidy or if they're getting it through the premium assistance program, the Medicaid expansion program. So those who it really directly affects are the ones who are paying full freight for their premium, both through the exchange and outside of the exchange. That's about 25,000 people.
Well, it's a big hit for them.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you about another idea included in this executive order that the governor said he likes with some, you know, with some caveats, and that is the promotion of purchasing insurance across state lines through these association health plans. How does the insurance department feel about these?
Well, we've been working with the governor on this, and the underlying history of it is that they could work well or not well depending on how you do it. And I think you heard the governor kind of explaining that. What you want to do is give small employers the chance to buy coverage collectively and get the benefit of large numbers, but you don't want in the process to lose the consumer protections that they have in their coverage or the solvency protections, and you don't want to negatively affect the market stability overall. So it depends on how you do it. Some of the ways that it's described sounds like just a shedding of all regulation, and that way of doing it is not going to help New Hampshire's insurance markets. But if you do it by preserving the consumer protections or this regional arrangement where there's a compact where the state regulation still applies, then it could work. And New Hampshire has tried to do that already, and it has some of those provisions in state law.
Well, Alex, I think we'll have to talk in a couple weeks as this all shakes out. I'll let you go for now. I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Alex Feldwebel, again, Deputy Commissioner for the State Department of Insurance. We're going to turn now to New Hampshire's congressional elections. And while you might be thinking, hey, that's more than a year away, you are right. But many, many potential candidates are now weighing the possibilities. Some have already jumped in. They're raising money. They're hiring staff. The political activity is especially heightened in the first congressional district. And we'll find out more. As always, let's hear from you, especially right now as you're in the first district. We'd like to hear your hopes for this race. We'll turn to the second district a little bit later in the hour. So if you're in the first district, give us a call. We'd love your thoughts, questions, observations, comments. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, 1-800-892-6477. I've got three people here to help us out with this story. Dan Tuohy is with us, digital engagement producer for NHPR. Dan, thank you so much.
Good morning.
Also with us, Paul Steinhauser, New Hampshire politics reporter, former CNN political reporter. Paul, great to see you.
Great to be here, Laura. Thank you.
And also Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. Dean, wonderful to have you too. And I want to start with you, Dean. This district is often called one of the most competitive around. How competitive is it, Dean?
It's certainly been very competitive over the last decade or so. If we look at Carol Shea Porter's time in office, she first won her seat in 2006. She lost it in 2010. She won it back in 2012, lost it again in 2014, and won it back in 2016. And what you see with her history, which is not unusual for seats in the U.S. House of Representatives, are her fortunes tended to rise and fall with the fortunes of the Democratic Party nationally. So 2006, when she wins, that's the so-called Democratic tsunami. Democrats take control of Congress. It was a bit of a backlash against George Bush's handling of the Iraq War. The economy was starting to slip. And then in 2010, when she lost her seat, that was the Tea Party Rebellion when Republicans took the House of Representatives. She won both of her races with President Obama at the top of the ticket, and she lost again in 2014 when the Republicans took back the U.S. Senate. So they'd already had the House. She's in the House, but then Republicans picked up the Senate in 14 as well. So it's very competitive, up and down. It is not unusual for House seats to really be at the mercy of the larger political dynamics in the country in terms of partisanship and ideology.
Well, so that's a great description of what I think NHPR's Casey McDermott called the first district, the swingiest of swing districts.
We call the swing states or purple states.
Yeah. Paul, what do you think?
Yeah, this is, you know, I spent a lot of time in D.C. covering national politics. This is a seat that national politicians and national strategists look at. Why? Because of what we just described. It is one of the most, as you said, the swingiest seats in a swing state. Okay, so it's a very swing state in a swing state in the first in a nation primary state. It's in a major media market in Boston. It's easy to get to from Washington. Once again, we will be flooded with outside money, not only from the national committees, but also from the super PACs. And also, we have an open seat for the first time in a long time. There is no incumbent, which makes this even more up for grabs. That's why this race, and there's no Senate race here in New Hampshire in 2018, this race is going to get a ton of attention here by national politicians and by national media. Get ready. This is going to be one fun ride.
All right. Well, buckling our seatbelts here in the studio already. Well, and Dean mentioned, Paul, the history. You know, a lot of listeners will know back and forth, Frank Inta, Carol Shea Porter. But I also read that the first district is one of a very few in the country that voted for President Trump and a Democrat in Congress. So more ticket splitting there.
Exactly. Trump carried the district slightly, and Carol Shea Porter very, very slightly won her old seat back. The district, of course, if you're not familiar with it, it starts in the Manchester-Bedford area, then it goes all the way over to the seacoast where I live, and then it goes up into the Lakes region and doesn't make it all the way up to North Conway, I don't think, but it heads up that way.
So, Dan Tuohy, there have been a number of Republicans who were already preparing to jump in and challenge what they thought would be Carol Shea Porter. So on the Republican side, who are we seeing, Dan?
Well, we already have at least two announced candidates in Eddie Edwards and Andy Sanborn. Andy, of course, being a state senator, and Eddie being the former chief of the Liquor Commission law enforcement. We have, with an open seat, as Paul said, it's an all play, as I like to call it, on both sides. People are saying, hey, why not? Let's take a look. On one hand, it is really early. On the other hand, you know, it's coming up very quickly here. Andy Martin, you know, he's the Republican, is also filed. He filed in July for this seat. Matt Mayberry, the former vice chairman of the party, he is leaning towards saying yes. He's still, you know, doing some legwork here and considering it. But it's just amazing when you talk about it. Another name that comes up possibly for this seat is Betty LaMontagne, you know, Ovid's wife. And you know,
still talking on the Republican side here.
Correct.
Dan, wow.
Correct. Yeah, you know, Betty was a force to be reckoned with the Carly Fiorina campaign in 2016. Very well connected in the conservative roots. And we'll see if she jumps into this race or perhaps for executive counsel for Chris Pappas' seat, the Democrat, if he runs for Congress.
Oh, no, that's interesting. And we should talk about that a little later, too. The fact that all these people are jumping in possibly to run for Congress opens up their seats. But hold on for a second there, because as we talk about Republicans who, you know, many of whom were already planning to challenge Carol Shea Porter, I want to play just a little clip from one of those Republican candidates, declared candidates. This is Republican State Senator Andy Sanborn on WMUR earlier this year, just outlining his campaign for the first district and his political philosophy. Let's hear.
I think our taxes are too high. I think our regulations are too steep. I think at this point government is trying to be everyone's master when it's supposed to be its servant. So my consistency in that value set of really working for the people of New Hampshire, I consider myself to be their employee, not their employer. And so I just try to put the people first, and they continue to say, my taxes are too high, the regulations too steep. Go over there to the State House, stand tall, stand firm for those types of things. And so that's this reputation I have is that I fight for the people first more so than I fight for, like, the establishment.
Okay, gentlemen, let's pick up on that last word, the establishment. And you probably heard the piece on NPR this morning that, you know, Steve Bannon has declared war on the establishment. This is nationally. So how does this message resonate in New Hampshire, Paul, among Republicans who are running in this first seat?
Andy Sanborn is probably arguably the most conservative member of the state Senate. He's also been very proud to kind of buck the system and go against State Senate President Chuck Morris and Senate Majority Leader as well, Jeb Bradley. And he's kind of proud to show that he's anti-establishment and willing to go against the establishment here in New Hampshire. That's the way he's going to run the campaign. He's going to say, I am the anti-establishment candidate and I am the true conservative. And in a Republican primary, running to the right is a good idea. And for us also, apologies to North Conway. I'm so sorry. All of Carroll County is in the first CD, including North Conway. I apologize, North Conway.
Well, and Dean Spiliotis, mm-hmm. Dan presented a pretty long list of Republican declared candidates and potential candidates. So what do you think about what Paul says, how these Republicans are going to kind of shake themselves out?
Yeah, you know, I think what we may see is kind of a microcosm of some of the bigger factions within the Republican Party. There is this kind of anti-establishment fervor that we saw certainly propelled Donald Trump into the presidency. I think to some extent the race, as congressional races always are, will be a referendum on Trump's performance. Andy Sanborn, certainly, if you followed him in the state Senate, kind of comes out of a Tea Party style background, fiscally conservative, as you heard in that clip. And so, I think that is what we're going to see. You know, to some extent, candidates always run as outsiders. That's really kind of become the tradition in our country. It is true, though, just to kind of take a step back for a moment. If you look at midterm elections in general, particularly the first midterm after a new president assumed office, it's very rare for the president to pick up seats. So you have so since the 1930s, we've only had two midterms, 1998 and 2002, in which the president's party picked up seats at the midterm.
Really?
Yeah, it's typically particularly the first term midterm, that first midterm after a new president. President's parties often take a hit. Maybe this will be unusual. 1998, you had a Democratic backlash to the Clinton impeachment. 2002, people rallied behind George W. Bush because it was right after 9/11. So you do have these moments where presidents can pick up. But people will likely run as outsiders. The question is whether there will be a backlash against the kind of Trump anti-establishment fervor, or that will be enough, or will that be enough to carry the day? But certainly, as Paul said, in the Republican primary, it's going to be all about that.
Go ahead, Paul.
And before we go to the Democrats, and boy, that list is huge.
Yes,
we can spend
5 days
talking about that. But on the Republican side, we just got the numbers for campaign cash. It matters, especially it's an early indicator at this early in a campaign of the strength of the campaign. Andy Sanborn raising $59,000 in the third quarter, which is July through September. Not a lot of money. Eddie Edwards, who's trying to be the first African-American congressman in New Hampshire, only $27,000. In the third quarter, even less money. That's not a lot. So I think that if I'm Matt Maybury right now thinking about this very seriously, I'm thinking, yeah, more seriously right now because neither of those two guys put up big numbers. Maybury, though, we're talking about anti-establishment. Going to be tough for him to run as the anti-establishment candidate. He was New Hampshire GOP vice chair for a couple of years. He is known around this state as being a real party guy.
Well, and you mentioned that rather long list of Republicans, even longer list of Democrats. And if folks want to just sort of take a peek at it. We've put up a list, an evolving list, I want to say, because, you know, people are jumping in and jumping out and saying maybe yes, maybe no. But it's on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. Our producer, Christina Phillips, labored mightily on this because there are a lot of names out there. But getting to something that you all said, and Dan, I think you said this as well, it seems early for people listening, right? Like, what are you guys talking about? It's more than a year away, a little more than a year away. Let's hear from a Democratic candidate for the first congressional district, possible Democratic candidate, whose name has come up a lot. This is Democratic Executive Counselor Chris Pappas. And here he is talking to you, actually, Paul Steinhauser, about his decision-making process and why he feels that he needs to decide soon. In fact, it is not that early.
You know, I don't know how long it will take, but I would say this, if I'm going to run and mount a campaign, I'll want to get in as quickly as possible and start actually putting that effort together. If I decide against it, then I want to give other people the opportunity to think about running and make sure that there's a candidate in place or candidates that are going to be running that are strong and are able to mount an impressive campaign.
Again, that's Democratic Executive Counselor Chris Pappas talking to Paul Steinhauser. So, Dan Tuohy, this is sort of what you were hinting at, that out of politeness to each other, first of all for fundraising, but second of all, out of politeness to their fellow Democrats, it's not too early for them to make these decisions because then the rest of the leaves start to fall.
Yeah, absolutely. Winning isn't everything. It's the only thing for both parties. And that's why they're searching their bench on either side of the aisle looking for someone who is a proven fundraiser, who's a proven winner. I mean, Chris Pappas is really well known. If he does enter, which seems likely, Will he scare away other Democrats from seeking their party nomination? I don't think so. As we mentioned, the list is long. Well, and again, it's a lot of trial balloons being floated here.
Yeah. It's interesting. You know, Pappas is somebody who has been targeted by the DNC before. There was some reporting back in 2016 that DNC was actually encouraging him to primary Carol Shea Porter. They were concerned about potentially losing the seat. He decided not to do that, but he's clearly somebody who would be able to bring in some party cash and also probably a decent amount of outside money. You know, I won't say that the nomination is his to lose, but I think he's getting out there with a pretty good head start in terms of name recognition, potential organization. But, you know, one of the nice things about an open seat is you don't have the usual asymmetry between an incumbent and a challenger in terms of resources and fundraising and visibility. But you know, to the extent that there is somebody who's relatively well-known among Democrats, that he would be the individual.
Go ahead,
the state party obviously will officially stay neutral in this race, but let's be honest, the Democratic establishment in this state, the establishment that backed Hillary Clinton in the 2016 primary, they want Chris Pappas. I think that's fair to say. Most of them want Chris Pappas. He will clear some people out of the field, but Dan's absolutely right, and Dean is as well. There are others that are definitely going to get in, regardless of what Chris Pappas does. But yeah, he's got the name recognition. He's young. He's the rising star, 37 years old. In that soundbite, you heard a lot of noise in the background because I was at the Puritan back room interviewing him. That's his restaurant. That's his family's restaurant, the famed back room, which has been in his family's for 100 years now. So.
Wow.
I thought that sounded familiar.
There you go.
I would say the
chicken tenders.
The Democratic establishment, Ray Buckley, the chairman, good luck getting him on the record saying that. I mean, they're staying
never
far
happened.
Clear
never
of this.
Happened.
After 2016 with Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, you know, Ray Buckley walked down the aisle almost hand in hand with Bernie to make sure he was on the ballot. And that's what I'm still looking to see. Is there a Bernie Sanders Democrat out there in either district to come out here and try to claim the mantle on behalf of the progressive wing.
Oh, that's a really good point that we will follow up on after a short break. Is the Democratic field so far, this big group of folks who say they would like to replace Carol Shea Porter, how are they going to shake out in terms of being the Bernie person or the not Bernie person? Got an email, too, to that effect, so I'll share that with you after a break. You can give us a call, too. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's a 2018 midterm election preview, and there has been a lot going on in terms of candidates shaking out, starting to form exploratory committees, starting to raise money, even though it seems early. For candidates and potential candidates, as we're hearing, it's not early. We've been talking about the first congressional district with an open seat there. We're going to finish that up. And then in a moment, we'll talk to some activity in the second district. It turns out there's been some things going on there as well. You can join us with your questions or comments, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Lots of names being thrown out there, and we have made a list on our website of some of the candidates who are in or who are possibly getting in. You can check it out at nhpr.org/exchange. So Dan Tuohy, Paul Steinhauser, Dean Spiliotis, here's an email from Christopher in Manchester who says, I think part of Carol Shea Porter's appeal was that although she's a liberal, she doesn't come across as elitist. Her Veterans Affairs work and average Jane affect her her average Jane affect make her more accessible to a broader swath of the electorate than a more effete traditional liberal might. Christopher, thank you for the comment. This is a really important point. And Dean, I'm going to go to you first.
Sure.
Who is going to be the sort of, you know, every man or every woman candidate? I mean, this is a split in the Democratic Party.
Right.
Who's sort of the on the ground average Jane or Joe, as Christopher puts it? And who is the more sort of liberal, the term you sometimes hear?
You know, it's hard to say. You really have to kind of see them at work on the stump for a while, and they'll get kind of a feel. I thought that email was on target. Carol Shea Porter really kind of did it through grassroots mobilization. If you remember back to 2006, she was not the establishment candidate. That was Jim Craig. Yet she has been sort of very tenacious and tending to the grassroots. She really as this sort of every woman kind of persona, her background in veterans issues, played quite well. I don't necessarily want to label Chris Pappas the establishment candidate, but Paul laid out a number of reasons for why I think the Democratic infrastructure would rally around him. We should also mention Mark McKenzie, who's a former AFL-CIO president was involved in labor for 25 years, a member of the New Hampshire House of Representatives. He is sort of more in the kind of the Bernie mold, if you want to kind of superimpose Democratic presidential politics on top of it. I've got a couple of military veterans mixed in there, Morris Sullivan, Terrence O'Rourke, not as well known, but that may help them to connect with people as well. So we'll see. A lot of this, you get a feel pretty quickly once you see these people interacting out on the stump.
Well, and Carol Shea Porter, again, was the sort of upstart, not well known at all in the district. So you're right,
Dean.
Yeah,
people wrote her off more than she was written off a number of times, and she managed to come back.
Sure.
And the beauty of Carol Shea Porter was she did it her way. She bucked the system in 06, as you guys mentioned, to win the nomination. She marched to the beat of her own drum, sometimes to the chagrin of a lot of Democrats in the state. And how about her announcement that she was not running for re-election?
Well, was that a surprise to you, Paul?
Caught almost everybody off surprise in the state. There may be a few Democrats that knew about it, but the vast majority that I was talking to, that Dan and others have talked to, were totally surprised. But to this back and forth, though, between maybe another repeat of Hillary versus Bernie in this primary, yeah, it could happen. And McKenzie is interesting. Labor leader, he's going to maybe get a lot of labor support if he runs. He announced an exploratory committee in an interview with the Concord Monitor. Also, he was one of the top Bernie supporters in the state. So it's interesting. I've quietly talked to some of those Bernie supporters, some of the steering committee for Bernie in the 16 primary, and they say that they're probably going to coalesce around one candidate. Now, I don't know if that's going to be a McKenzie or a Rennie Cushing if he runs, the state rep from Hampton, but we could possibly get another establishment versus very progressive battle in this district. We could.
Well, it's an interesting list of folks, and some with some pretty impressive experience. You know, we've got mayors, we've got state reps, we've got, as Dean said, people with military experience, somebody who was Assistant Secretary, Maura Sullivan, Assistant Secretary of Veterans Affairs during the Obama administration. So an interesting list of folks. And again, it's on our website if you want to take a look at it, nhpr.org/exchange. It's an evolving list, though. Again, people are making all sorts of decisions. Dan Tuohy, before we switch to the second district, because there's some activity there as well, anything else that you want folks to think about or to understand about this first district race?
I think we always go back to this narrative, like, what does this mean? You know, it's a race for the first district or second district, as it were. What does it mean? Is there a national narrative? I think there is with President Trump. Will there be a Trump backlash? You know, some Republicans say, well, it may be, but it won't be as big as Democrats want it to be.
Yeah, and also we noted earlier, this is a district, Paul, right, that went for President Trump last time. At the same time, it elected Carol Shea Porter, so it has an independent mind.
It does, and we see it every 2 years. It goes back and forth like a ping pong ball.
One more thing on money. I mean, Carol Shea Porter's announcement was strange for me as well, because you know she is a member of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee's frontline, which is like an incumbent protection committee. So I mean, she was getting some cover, and the chairwoman of that committee is none other than Annie Custer.
I did not know that. Okay, so go ahead, Paul.
Some final intrigue in the first district. Big announcement this morning. Guess who's coming to headline the Stratford County, which is in the district, their big fall fundraising dinner on Sunday? Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont. It'll be interesting to see who shows up among these potential candidates to kind of maybe get their picture taken with Senator Sanders.
Okay, all right. Well, we will look forward to that. And maybe you guys will talk about that on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup for sure. That's some good fodder there. We should turn to, though, the second district. This is the more westernmost western district in New Hampshire, covers more liberal towns like Keene and Concord and Hanover and so forth. And Dean Spiliotis, on that side, Emma Klein Custer, the Democratic incumbent, is running for re-election. No major primary activity there. But what's happening on the Republican side, Dean?
Well, so far we have three candidates who are in Jack Flanagan, former state rep and majority leader under Speaker Sean Jasper, Stuart Levinson, who was the director of the medical director of Manchester VA, is the whistleblower for the whole substandard care issue down there, and Steve Negrin, who's an engineer and a new state rep from Nashua. So right now it looks like we have three candidates on the Republican side. You know, in terms of the dynamics of this race, Annie Custer's been in for three terms. She's a good fundraiser. She's got something like $2 million on hand, or has raised $2 million for this race. You know, one of the big challenges for House seats, you don't see it so much for U.S. Senate seats, is this asymmetry in cash and visibility and resources between incumbents and challengers. She also will have the benefit of it being the first midterm after a new Republican president, one who's particularly polarizing. So, you know, there's sort of a lot of things that the sort of winds would typically be blowing in her favor. She had a fairly narrow race against Jim Lawrence the last time around, but again, President Trump was elected. So, you know, you never know. But I think, you know, her plan is to sort of, this will be kind of a fairly typical kind of incumbent defense of a seat.
Well, and you mentioned Republican State Representative Steve Negrin, who just got in officially for the second congressional district. I want to play a clip of his announcement speech. It's a little long, but there are a couple key points in there that I think we might hear from other Republicans in this second congressional district race. So let's hear Steve Negrin.
Representative Custer has demonstrated clearly year after year after year, her loyalty isn't to the citizens of this great state. They are to her own personal and party agenda. Representative Custer is a reliable party line vote. She consistently votes with Democrats more than 90% of the time. In 2013, 95% of the time. 14, 91% of the time. 15 through 16, 94% of the time. And to date, 95% of the time of the party. And this is a performance she was critical of her past opponents. Just to put Representative Custer's position within the Democratic caucus in D.C. clearly in focus, since 2013, Ann Custer was more liberal and ideological than San Francisco's Pelosi.
Again, that's Republican State Representative Steve Negrin just announcing his campaign in the last couple of days. So, Paul, what do you think about this theme? Are we going to hear this in the 2nd District? More liberal than Pelosi.
Pelosi, Pelosi, Pelosi. There you go again. And remember, Nancy Pelosi came here just before the election last year, right here in Concord, and headlined a fundraiser and event for Annie Custer. So, yeah, I think all the Republicans, whoever the nominee is, Beto Negron or any of the others, will try to marry the two together. It's been an effective way to campaign for Republicans against Pelosi for a decade now. It'll continue again in this campaign. We mentioned the money. She raised a boatload of money last quarter, $426,000. She's well on her way to once again raising $3 million for her House reelection campaign. She's done 4 campaigns in a row now. But money isn't everything. I mean, she outspent Jim Lawrence last time around, and it was a very close contest. So money's important, but not
everything.
Remind
us, it was close last time.
5 points.
Okay, given that he was almost unknown. And
didn't
she's
spend
a
much money. Didn't have much money either.
Well, and this comes also at a time, Dean, when Nancy Pelosi is facing some, I don't want to say rebellion within her ranks, but sure, why not? Rebellion within her ranks. People feel like she's been there for a long time. It's time for a new generation.
Yeah, there has been some criticism of her and the Democratic leadership in the House as a whole. It's a very old leadership. Most of the folks are in their mid-70s or older, and there has been some pushing from younger Democrats to turn over the leadership to a new generation. I just saw her on television this weekend. Doesn't sound like she's planning on going anywhere, but there is that kind of subtext. I just have to comment on the argument that Mr. Negrin made about the voting with her party 90% of the time. In the House of Representatives, virtually everybody votes with their party 90% of the time, particularly if you're a new member. If he were to win and he were to vote with his party lower than 90% of the time, he'd end up with an office in the basement with no windows and no ability to move his agenda. The House of Representatives is a hierarchical organization.
There are not lots
of members of the House who are voting in opposition to their parties. It just doesn't happen. You find yourself with no money, no ability to move an agenda, and a really crummy office. So I hear that argument every 2 years, and it's just a throwaway argument. Most members of the House of Representatives vote with their parties over 90% of the time. You can argue that maybe she's too liberal, but that argument on either side that, well, they vote 90% of the time, he will find himself voting 90% of the time with Speaker Ryan if he's elected.
Well, although he pointed out in that clip, she made the same complaint about Charlie Bass.
Everyone does. Both sides. This is not just
Republicans. It sounds like an effective line.
It's meaningless.
Dan, other thoughts about sort of the arguments that we're going to hear these Republicans make in the 2nd District against Congresswoman Custer?
I think health care is a preset in this debate going forward. I think in the 2nd District, it's already baked in. It's veterans issues. You have Dr. Levinson, who was a whistleblower at the Manchester VA. Steve Negron's also a veteran. He'll be bringing up these issues. You know, I think he was an ICBM missile officer, if I recall. And this is something that's going to come up. Jim Lawrence, you know, he got in the race really late last time as well. So maybe he might do that as well. Maybe he's sitting in the wings, in the shadows, waiting to see how this field shakes up.
Well, you're right. Healthcare, and especially veterans healthcare, will be a big issue regardless of who is in the race. And bigger still, because we do have 2 military veterans on the Republican side. Excuse me, 1 military veteran so far on the Republican side. But you're right, Dan. Stuart Levinson, his name, if listeners are going, gee, I've heard that name, he was one of the key whistleblowers in that whole Manchester VA upset when the Globe Spotlight team unveiled some real problems there. The day that he announced his campaign for the 2nd Congressional District, Dr. Levinson spoke with NHPR's Peter Biello, and he told Peter that he was running because, in his words, he was tired of remaining on the sidelines while Washington does nothing. Let's hear.
You hear about gridlock in Washington. To me, it's a day-to-day problem of trying to take care of patients. It becomes an academic discussion in Washington, but it becomes a real situation when I'm in a room with a patient and I can't get them the care they need.
Again, that's Dr. Stuart Levinson, candidate on the Republican side for the 2nd Congressional District, talking to NHPR's Peter Biello. Paul, what do you think? Veterans issues will probably be big, if not bigger than expected.
Yeah, yeah. And Levinson, in that interview with Peter Biello, and I interviewed him that same day, who was also very critical of Custer. She sits on the House Veterans Affairs Committee. And he criticized her for taking credit for helping the vets. And he said, you know, she has not been there to help. this is going to be an issue if Levinson or Negron win the primary next September. They are really going to go after Custer on this issue, which in this state is extremely important. Come on. I mean, this is, I guess, per capita, we have the highest percentage of vets of any state in the country, and we don't have a full-service VA facility anywhere in the state. This is going to be a big issue.
Well, and we talked earlier in the hour about health care with Governor Sununu and the insurance department as well. What do you think, Dean? How are you going to hear these Republican candidates talking about health care? We know that Congresswoman Custer is going to say, you know, the Affordable Care Act's important. It should stay in place.
Yeah, well, you know, there is some variation among Republicans, but the typical argument, and we heard it at the top of the show with Governor Sununu talking about, you know, Obamacare being a disaster and failing, et cetera. You know, the big question is, if you buy into the argument that President Trump is able to put in motion either a sort of a repeal or a series of executive orders that will lead to the inevitable dissolution of the exchanges, then I think a lot of the debate is going to be about what comes next. I mean, certainly on the Democratic side, particularly in that first CD, it'll probably be about a single payer and Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All proposal. But, you know, it's amazing to me, so many years out from the passage of Obamacare, that we're still sort of discussing, you know, whether or not it should exist. And I think, you know, Republicans are going to continue to push for a repeal. But the debate will be about how to replace and how to make sure, particularly as we heard early in the show, for those folks who are going to be hit particularly hard by the loss of the cost sharing.
Well, gentlemen, we started this discussion by saying, as Dan Toohey said, you know, yes, if you're listening, you're a voter, you're thinking it's really early. But just remind us, all of you, maybe you first, Paul, how it's not early and what you're going to be watching for in the next couple weeks in terms of, you know, filings or money or committees or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, who officially jumps in on the Democratic side, who sets up exploratory committees? Endorsements at this early stage matter. And then, of course, you know, at the end of the year, at the beginning of next year, when we see the fourth quarter fundraising numbers, these are all important early indicators before people get to really vote, before the candidates go out and actually really speak to the, you know, the voters. These are important indicators that those of us who cover campaign politics will closely monitor.
Well, and as you said earlier, who goes to that, you know, talk that Bernie Sanders gives, you know, and who gets that really nice picture? Dan, what other sort of things do you watch as this progresses? Again, early for voters, but not for campaigns.
I think the overall picture here, where it's a midterm election. In New Hampshire, we do not have a U.S. senator up for re-election. So that's a big deal, I think. So that may tamp down some of the big money flowing in from out of state. And, you know, looking ahead, we have, you know, the guy at the top of the ticket is Republican, Chris Sununu. And we've seen he's already gone out campaigning for state rep candidates in some of these special elections. And see how much, you know, shoe leather he devotes to this campaign.
Coattails, so to speak.
Yes.
Given his relative popularity, Dan, is that what I understand?
Yeah, according to the polls, his popularity is holding strong.
Okay. What about you, Dean? What are you going to be looking for and following on?
Yeah. I think Dan is right. I mean, to the extent that there's no U.S. Senate race, no presidential race, this is going to be a relatively high profile set of House races, particularly in the first CD. You know, part of deciding whether or not to get into a race really depends on your ability to size up your competition within your party. So we're going to see, I think, you know, right now we're sort of in the mentions portion where people are getting mentioned. But I think there's going to be a lot of sizing up of the competition for those primaries. And I think some people will either get in or get out based on whether or not they think they have an opportunity, given what other people decide. So everybody's sort of jockeying and watching each other at this point.
Okay, well, Paul Steinhauser, Dean Spiliotis, Dan Toohey, thank you so much. Lots of fun. I really appreciate you guys being here.
Thanks, Laura.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, revisiting the Vietnam War. This fall's PBS documentary revived a national conversation on how and why the war was fought and lessons learned from the conflict, in which nearly 60,000 Americans died, with many more injured in body and mind.
We talk with Granite State veterans about their experiences and how the film affected them. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 7 p.m. on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.